For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. We are sponsored by The Nation magazine and widely available on all podcasting platforms. And I'm also told available on some radio stations. Wherever you listen to us, I welcome you to the program. We're taking up today, the continuing crisis in the Middle East and maybe how Donald Trump had promised a new policy, but it looks a lot like the old policy, maybe even a little bit worse. And I'm very happy to have on friend of the program, Yosef Manier, who's the head of the Palestine-Israel project at the Arab Center in Washington. And maybe just like to take it up with the immediate news, which is after the supposed ceasefire, it has been broken. And I think we should be very clear about this, because I think a lot of the Western media is not clear about this. It was broken by Israel, unilaterally deciding to end the ceasefire. And now the level of violence in Gaza is, I think, higher than it's ever been in the last 18 months. Yosef, welcome, and thoughts on this.
Yeah, thank you, G, for having me. You're absolutely correct. We are seeing a resumption of the very high level of violence that has characterized most of the last 18 months, particularly up until late January, when a ceasefire agreement that took months to be secured finally went into effect just as Donald Trump was being inaugurated into the office of the president. To be completely frank and accurate, while this ceasefire deal has been in effect for several weeks now, one side has not entirely ceased firing. And in fact, throughout this period, 150, around that number of Palestinians have been killed in Gaza by Israeli fire, again, during this period of the so-called ceasefire. In addition to continuing to kill Palestinians during the ceasefire period, the Israelis have also failed to live up to the obligations that they agreed to in the ceasefire agreement when it came to ensuring the transfer of humanitarian aid into the Gaza Strip. And as the ceasefire progressed, as the period of the ceasefire progressed, they continued even more to fail to live up to those obligations and ultimately announced that they were ending the provision of humanitarian aid all together. Despite all of that, on the Palestinian end, they have largely lived up to what they committed to, which was a very clearly defined process of releasing Israelis held captive in Gaza in exchange for Palestinians being held captive by Israel. This was a scheduled and clearly enumerated process that was supposed to unfold throughout the entirety of the first phase of the ceasefire. And for the most part, it went off without a hitch. What was obvious at the outset, I think, of the ceasefire, Jeet, was that there was a confluence of interests between the Israelis, the Americans, and the Palestinians to get to the first phase of the ceasefire. From the American perspective, obviously, this is something that the Biden administration had been trying to achieve. The Israelis were not willing to cooperate. But after many months, and particularly as they saw an opportunity to present Donald Trump with an inauguration gift, the Israelis agreed to the ceasefire agreement just as Donald Trump was coming to office. So from the Israeli perspective, the first phase of the ceasefire was an opportunity to shrink the problem of the hostages. It gave them a chance to reduce the number of Israelis being held in Gaza without having to end the war. The first phase of the ceasefire was about exchanges, but did not require Israel to end the war. The second phase, though, would move in that direction. And this is why it was obvious from the outset that the Israelis were very unlikely to move to the second phase of the ceasefire. And in fact, this is what happened. As we came towards the end of the first phase of the ceasefire, the Israelis objected to moving to the second phase and wanted instead to renegotiate the terms, this time with Trump in the White House and his envoy, Steve Witkoff, by their side. When it became clear that the Palestinians were not going to renegotiate the terms of the ceasefire all over again and instead demand that the Israelis stick to the terms that they agreed to, the Israelis decided that they were going to restart the massive bombardment campaigns that they have this week. I think for those of us who've been watching this closely, we expected this to happen at the end of the first phase. And lo and behold, here we are.
Yeah, no. What are the factors that are involved aside from kind of, you know, Israeli rejectionism and desire for different terms? I think one thing that people are mentioning, and I think you mentioned on social media, is Benjamin Netanyahu's political fortune, that he is very invested in the war continuing, because once it stops, he'll be held accountable for, frankly, his failures on October 7. Do you want to expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I mean, look, Benjamin Netanyahu has based his entire political career on the idea that he is Mr. Security, that he's the one who knows how to protect Israelis. And, you know, that entire persona was shattered on October 7th, 2023, when he was the prime minister that presided over the single greatest security failure in modern Israeli history. Of course, he wasn't the only one in government during that time, but he is the guy at the top. He is the guy that is ultimately responsible. And despite that, many of the people around him who were in charge of the security state have since taken some form of accountability, initiated investigations into their own agencies and their own failures, and many of them resigned. But the one person who is ultimately responsible has been seeking to evade accountability as much as he possibly can. He's refused to permit a state-led inquiry into the failures of the government. He has instead pursued this military strategy of seeking to achieve the aims of the war that the government has set forward. I think what Israelis and really the entire world has seen, but especially over the last several weeks, is that despite genocidal level violence, the Israeli military was not able to achieve its objectives in Gaza. It was able to achieve the destruction of the vast majority of infrastructure in Gaza, the killing of tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of civilians. But it has not achieved the destruction of Hamas, nor did it succeed in freeing the hostages being held there. The only thing that led to the release of hostages was a negotiated agreement. And that contrast could not have been clearer over the last several months, as Israelis have watched week after week of these exchanges happening in accordance with the negotiated agreement. The vast majority of Israelis today want to see the Israeli government continue on to phase two of the agreement. The Israeli government, led by Benjamin Netanyahu, does not want to go there. Instead, he is interested in continuing this war because he understands when this war ends, it's going to be time for him to be held accountable. And the only way, frankly, that Benjamin Netanyahu stays out of prison is if he stays in office. He has multiple indictments against him in Israel, internationally, now with the International Criminal Court indicting him for war crimes. And, you know, if he is out of power, it's likely he's not going to be able to avoid prison. And so, you know, to keep his government together, to keep the hardline right-wing nationalists that he needs around him to keep a majority, he's decided instead to go against the entire world, which wants to see a ceasefire, go against the vast majority of Israelis who want to see a continuation onto phase two of this ceasefire, and instead return to all-out war against the Palestinian people in Gaza.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an important point to underscore. And, you know, like, I'm personally, I have been reluctant to too much emphasize internal divisions within Israeli society, because at least at the earlier phase of the war, you know, it had overwhelming popular support, despite, you know, important dissident elements, including many of the families of the hostages. But now it does seem like there is like a difference. And so now it's not just, you know, the U.S. Giving unlimited support to Israel. It's giving unlimited support to Netanyahu to stay in power, which seems like a very different thing. But I mean, like, to what extent is the American state with Trump, you know, able to make that distinction, like to try to distinguish between Israel and Netanyahu?
Yeah, it's an important question. I mean, one thing I would say about the domestic politics piece that I think is really important is remember where we were in terms of Israeli politics prior to October 7th, right? The country was going through an unprecedented domestic crisis over the government's decision to effectively weaken the judiciary and to pass legislation that would reshape Israel in favor of sort of its theocratic wing, right, for many years to come. This led to nonstop protests. It led to all kinds of civil strife. It led to resignations in the government. And it was very clear that these were the conditions that distracted the Israeli state on the eve of October 7th. And this is, you know, this is not something that Israelis have forgotten, particularly Israelis who have long argued that the prioritization of the religious nationalist right on the part of the government has put Israeli security in jeopardy from the very beginning. And so this element has always been there, and it's become all that more pronounced in recent weeks as it's become very clear that Netanyahu is putting his own personal political interests above the national interests, above the interests of the hostages, and really above anything else. Now, when it comes to Trump, I think you're right. There was a question at the beginning of this ceasefire deal about how much Trump and his administration and his envoy, Steve Witkoff, would be able to press Netanyahu to actually deliver and uphold his end of the bargain. And in fact, Witkoff's involvement even prior to the inauguration, led many to think that, Trump was able to push the ceasefire deal over the finish line. And there may be something to that. I fall in the camp of believing that, honestly, Netanyahu had wanted to give this reward to Trump, and that's the reason that he was holding off more than anything else. But also in recent weeks, I mean, one of the things we saw as it became clear that the Israelis were not interested in moving to phase two, and that the Americans still wanted to see progress on the ceasefire deal, was that it seemed that the Americans were willing to try different avenues to get to those objectives, including having a White House authorized envoy who was charged with the task of, the portfolio of the hostages, this Adam Bowler, who actually carried out direct talks with Hamas for the first time ever, something unprecedented in U.S. policy. And it, I think, sent a message that the Trump administration wanted to see progress on this hostage issue, and they weren't 100% sure if Netanyahu wanted to see the same. And so they were exploring different avenues. Now, of course, the Israelis went berserk when they found out that this was going on. They made a big stink about it. They had their allies here in the United States make a big stink about it as well. And it seems as though Trump's hostage envoy, Adam Bowler, was effectively sidelined, and that these talks, these direct talks with Hamas, did not continue. And this seems to be where things have effectively fallen apart in the negotiations. They were going on as recently as days before the Israelis decided to once again escalate their bombardment of Gaza. And what may be happening here, and time will tell, is it is perhaps the case that the Trump administration said, okay, you know what? You guys want to try your way? We'll let you try your way. You don't want us to talk to Hamas. You don't want us to work through the mediators. You don't want to move to phase two. We'll give you some space to try your way, and we'll see how much you'll be able to be successful with that. Even though, of course, we've seen how successful they were with that for 16 months. But Trump seems to be giving them the opportunity now to go ahead and try that again. The question is, what will happen when no progress is made with that? Trump is obviously a very erratic and dangerous personality. He's hard to read. But one thing about him is he likes to claim his victories. And he likes to be given credit for his victories. And I think he was very happy to claim credit for hostages being released. He was very happy to claim credit for the ceasefire initially going into effect. And I believe he would have wanted to claim credit for the remaining Americans who are held in Gaza to also be released. That's something that Hamas had agreed to as recently as days before this escalation, but the Israelis shot down. Because they wanted to see Israelis, not just Americans, released from Gaza as well. So how long is Trump going to be patient with this Israeli approach, knowing that there is an opportunity to get more hostages out by going a different direction? That's, I think, an important question.
Yeah, no, I mean, Trump's whole behavior in this is really worth, I think, closer attention than some people are willing to give. And I don't want to make any great claims for Trump. I think his approach to diplomacy is often like very dangerous, and is actually, I think, the root of many of these problems, especially the move towards the Abraham Accords during the first term. But having said that, as you say, he likes his victories. He likes especially to be known as a deal maker. I'm someone who can make a deal. We
and
see this
get
with
the deal done.
Get the deal done. We see this with the Ukraine and Russia. That's a big part of his self-conception. And he doesn't also does not like to be seen as controlled by other forces. And I think that, you know, like this is something that I think Democrats don't want to hear, but they need to hear, which is that there is a difference between Joe Biden's approach, which was no daylight. There will be no daylight between the United States and Israel, and what the Trump administration did, at least very briefly with Adam Bowler, where it was saying, like, actually, no, the U.S. has its own interests in the Middle East. We are not an agent of Israel, which is what I believe Adam Bowler said. And of course, that caused a reaction and it caused them to be sidelined. But it is noteworthy that Trump was someone in the Trump administration was willing to say that. And no one in the Biden administration ever said, you know, that the U.S. is not an agent of Israel. So, you know, like that at least creates an opening and also creates, I think, a lot of anxiety on the part of both the Israeli government and their allies in the United States. But I mean, the other thing to think about Trump is, even though he likes to be seen as independent, he is beholden to, you know, various interests. To what degree, like once there was pushback against negotiating with Hamas, Trump obviously would have heard from someone like his Miriam Adelson, who is, you know, his single greatest donor I think two presidential runs. How much does his need to satisfy that donor base override like any of the sort of, you know, let's make a deal, let's look after America first considerations?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I mean, I think the other thing too about Trump is not just he wants to be known as a deal maker, but he's willing to try unorthodox methods to get to achieving a deal, right? I mean, this is ultimately the American president that went and met with Kim Jong-un, right? So he's willing to do the taboo if he thinks that it can create some kind of progress. And he doesn't care about the kind of normal constraints. Let's keep in mind that when the Biden administration was attempting to negotiate this ceasefire deal, they were in the midst of an election campaign. And so they were at a far more vulnerable position when it came to domestic constraints than Trump is. I think the Adelson question is an interesting one for a couple of reasons. First, I mean, obviously, I expect that Miriam Adelson has a direct line to Donald Trump. I expect that she's making her perspective to Trump perfectly clear. At the same time, there have been doubts about exactly what her position is on this issue. And there have been some suspicions that even though the Adelsons have long been strong supporters of Netanyahu in Israeli politics, there's some daylight, if you will, between the Adelsons and Netanyahu over the handling of this hostage issue. And in fact, Adelson was directly involved in facilitating the meetings between Israeli hostages and the American president in recent weeks, who felt that the Israeli prime minister was not really representing their interests. And so they wanted to come to speak to Trump directly. Miriam Adelson was involved in making that happen. Exactly what her position on this is not 100% clear, although there's no doubt that she is, of course, super pro-Israel. It's just a difference of strategy with and priorities with the Israeli prime minister in this moment. But, even though she was a major donor to the Trump campaign, Trump is not running for re-election. And frankly, he doesn't need Miriam Adelson's money. So the question is, what kind of leverage does that actually create over Trump? I don't know. I'm not really sure that it is super significant over Trump at this moment. But there's no doubt that, she has a direct line to the president. Last thing I will just say on this. Which I think is important. The real danger that I think the Israelis saw with the Bowler approach was not so much that he was having direct talks with Hamas. That's not something that they liked, of course. But the real problem was a bigger one. The real problem was that what Bowler was negotiating with Hamas over was a separate release of captives who were American citizens as well as Israeli citizens, that the United States, through their representative, was directly advocating for the release of American citizens because they were American citizens. Now, that shouldn't be a weird thing for anybody at all, right? That America would advocate for the release of their people. But the precedent that it sets, that the United States would separate from Israel in these negotiations, was, I think, one that the Israelis could not accept. Okay, the precedent that the United States could get what it needed and then perhaps cut bait is not something that the Israelis would allow to happen. And this is something that I think they pushed back on the hardest. It wasn't so much that there was these conversations going on, but what the conversations were about and what precedent it would set for the United States and Israel to go after these objectives separately as opposed to together, right? The greatest leverage the Israelis have is that they are in lockstep with the United States in these negotiations more than anything else. And they don't want anything that would create a fissure in that approach that could perhaps widen over time in these negotiations. And I think that is perhaps where they were able to push back the hardest and say to say to Trump, look, you know, if we go down this road, it's going to make the release of more hostages even more difficult for us. And we have to stick through this thing together, and we can't put Americans over Israelis and so on and so forth. So I think that may have had a lot to do with it.
Yeah, no, I think that makes a lot of sense. Although, I mean, like, it maybe shows the sort of contradictions of Trump's America First approach, because what he was doing with Adam Boiler was America First, and now it seems like it's America First with an Israeli exception. But even so, I think that the fact there's an opening, at least briefly, is very significant. Since we had been talking about Adelson, to just round out that discussion, I do think that there's one area where maybe she has had an influence, and it's been, I think, reported by Ellie Clifton in Responsible Statecrafts, which is the crackdown on pro-Palestine speech in universities, and particularly in Columbia, where Clifton basically suggests that she's been at the forefront of this in terms of taking of Mahmoud Khalil as a political prisoner, the expulsion, suspension, and revocation of degrees from other students at Columbia. So do you want to talk about a bit about that, like how this maybe the biggest crackdown on free speech by the American state since McCarthyism plays into Israel-American relations?
Yeah, look, there's no doubt that the Adelsons have been major investors in this objective for years. This is not new. I remember back in 2015, actually, Sheldon Adelson was still alive at the time, and he was sort of the driving force. Then he had hosted a conference in Las Vegas for all of these different pro-Israel advocacy groups, along with actors from the Israeli government, to kind of create a joint coherent strategy to fight back against criticism of Israel in the United States. Now, of course, they do not frame this as fighting criticism of Israel, but that's effectively what it ends up being. They dress it up in language of countering anti-Semitism or countering anti-Israel sentiment or what have you. But criticism of a government's policies is protected speech, protected by the First Amendment, and it's something that these groups don't want to see. Miriam Adelson, the Adelsons in general, have been major funders of this approach, but so have many others. And the Israeli government has been an important player in all of this. They have agencies within the Israeli government that are specifically tasked at coordinating these efforts internationally, not just in the United States, but working with what they call the pro-Israel network around the world to go on offense against critics of Israel. This is the sort of key principle in their strategy, what they call shifting from defense to offense. In other words, they recognize that they have a reputation problem. People around the world are increasingly critical of Israel because of what it's doing to Palestinians. And defending themselves is not working, right? It's simply not enough anymore to defend yourself against this criticism. They believe that they need to go on the offensive against the critics. And this has taken, different shapes over time. We started to see groups that support this advocate for things like anti-BDS laws, right? Effectively laws that would, advance punitive measures against people who advocated for the boycott of Israel or Israeli products, or the boycott of companies, even American companies, who were profiting off of Israeli human rights abuses. You know, we saw those laws proliferate throughout the United States. We saw laws like that in Europe. And then we started to see other steps as well, including the effort to redefine anti-Semitism as criticism of Israel. And the reason that that was so important is because if you can take criticism of Israel and turn it into discrimination, well, now suddenly it loses its First Amendment protections. And now you can attack criticism of Israel with existing anti-discrimination laws and the law enforcement mechanisms of the state. And this is what we're increasingly starting to see now. The law enforcement mechanisms of the state beginning to be deployed against critics of Israel, against protesters, against anyone who is going to take a public stand against this genocide. And so this has been a long time coming. It is reaching this point today and will likely escalate further as more norms continue to fall. And as this, Trump administration continues to favor the growth of a police state here in America.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly the dynamic at work. I did want to emphasize though an interesting point, which is a divergence from McCarthyism, which rested on a bipartisan Cold War consensus of anti-communism that was very widely shared in the United States in the late 40s and 50s. And so you had large parts of the population that were sympathetic with this. To me, one divergence from that with the contemporary moment is here again, you have a state-sponsored crackdown on speech with some political bipartisan support. I mean, certainly the difference between Chuck Schumer and Donald Trump on this is not large. But on the other hand, in terms of public opinion, you're not seeing a huge buy-in from this. That actual support for Israel is polarizing, between Republicans and Democrats. And now there's a lot of very consistent polls showing that among Democrats, sympathy for Palestinians is much greater than sympathy for Israel, and that support for Israel among Democrats and to a lesser extent, but a real extent, among independents is steadily going down. And is it a historical low? So, my question is, how do you see this playing out? This increasing unpopularity of Israel, frankly, in civil society, with a state-sponsored crackdown on speech about Israel.
Yeah, I actually think this gap that you describe, the gap between public opinion on this issue and policy on this issue, which is a massive gap, is the reason that we're seeing this escalating repression. Mm-hmm. There are a few things in American politics that enjoy more bipartisan support, particularly at the highest levels of government, than sending billions of dollars worth of weapons to Israel on a constant basis. The no daylight approach to U.S.-Israel relations. That's never been reflected in American public opinion. And it's never been less reflected in American public opinion than today. For years, the vast majority of the American public was in a place where they wanted the United States to take an even-handed approach to the Israeli-Palestinian issue. But that's not where our policy has been. And that's largely because of the role of interest groups. And that's not unique to the Israeli-Palestinian issue. That's just how American politics work. And we have seen a gap in public opinion and policy on other issues. Take a look at, for example, on gun control. The vast majority of Americans want to see greater gun control, and yet policy doesn't move in that direction. Why is that? Well, it's because interest groups have a significant role to play in shaping policy. The same is clear here on the Israeli-Palestinian issue. But what's happening now is it's not just that a majority wants to see an even-handed approach. But more and more Americans, particularly among Democrats, and not just Democrats, but also independents, as you note, are becoming increasingly critical of Israel, want to see an end to U.S. weapons supplies to Israel, and are acting out on that in a lot of different ways. You know, the protests that we saw on college campuses were the biggest mobilization of Americans on any foreign policy issue probably since the the war in Iraq in 2003. And we saw thousands of students getting arrested, willing to pay a significant price to have their voice heard. America on this issue today is not where it was 10 years ago, and certainly not 20 years ago. And because of that, there's a real threat to the consensus around U.S. policy to Israel. And that presents a challenge to the very interest groups who want to see that consensus maintained. And so how do you hold on to that? How do you hold on to that consensus? Well, you have to find a way to shut these critics up, because this is not a widely held consensus. This is a consensus that is upheld by interest groups who are playing a big role in shaping this policy, but not something that ever had very deep American public support. And so now the game is, well, how do we shut these people up? How do we repress these movements? And so because this gap continues to grow, repression continues to be the tool that they would like to turn to, because that's the only way to hold this thing together. And ultimately, it's going to backfire. But in the meantime, I think things will get pretty ugly.
Yeah, no. I mean, the short-term ugliness, I agree, will increase. But I do want to think a little bit about the sort of the broader dynamics at work, because it seems to me that, you know, if you have a public that has, you know, not bought into the pro-Israel policy, is increasingly turned against it, is unhappy with it. But you know, because it's foreign policy, it's not a top priority concern. But once it becomes the repression makes this a domestic issue. If you're telling Americans that, you know, not only do you have to pay your tax dollars go to fund this killing abroad, but you will have less First Amendment rights in America, and that green card holders will have less First Amendment rights in America, and that universities will be much more subject to, you know, the control of Donald Trump because of this Israel policy. Like, to me, this seems like a classic formula for radicalization, for like really, and actually political polarization. Like, I would imagine that a lot of normie Democrats, you know, who aren't happy with the Israel policy, but don't prioritize it, like, suddenly this has becomes a poster child for, like, you know, Trumpian repression at its worst is tied with this pro-Israel policy.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, this is why repression is really a tool of the weak. It's not a tool of the strong, right? The strong don't need to use coercion to get people to go along, right? The problem is the idea of U.S. support for Israel. It was an idea that used to have sort of a hegemonic domination in American society, and that's fallen apart over years. You know, repression becomes necessary to kind of maintain the status quo. But as you note, right, the risks of that approach are, of course, mobilizing even more people against you. And this is something that I think is not lost on supporters of Israel and supporters of this repressive approach. They just don't feel that they have another option. Yeah, they're willing to accept these risks. They're at a point where they feel that the entire idea of U.S. support for Israel is perhaps a generation, maybe even half a generation away from being really challenged because of where Americans are on this issue. And we have just begun to see the impact of the 16-month genocide that has taken place on mobilizing people in the generation that is coming into political consciousness now. So you can imagine what the next 5-10 years will be like if there is no crackdown. And that's precisely why they're leaning heavy into the crackdown now. Not because they this is their first choice of action, but because they feel like they have no other choice of action.
Well, in that sense, there's a perfect unity between what's happening in the Middle East and what's happening in the U.S. I mean, in some ways, what they're trying to do is to turn the United States into a kind of Israel, you know, and that Israeli repression in Gaza and elsewhere is also a tactic of the weak. That is to say, they have the power to destroy, but not the power to win a consensus or win lasting acceptance.
You've mentioned this a couple of times, but I think it's worth underscoring just how much the war in Gaza has failed, because according to American intelligence, and I believe Israeli intelligence as well, their big concern now is that Hamas is as strong in Gaza as it was before October 7th. That is to say, after the 16 months of fighting and all the destruction, which is by the reckoning of the United Nations the most intense killing of civilians that we've seen since the Rwandan genocide. After all that, Hamas has as much a hold on Gaza as ever. So what they're doing is continuing a failed policy because they have no other policy. And maybe to just round it out, because we have a few more minutes, the failed policy is not only, and I think people need to understand this, in Gaza, is not only Gaza and the West Bank, but is in a larger relationship with the region, where like currently the United States and Israel are together, bombing in Yemen, in Lebanon, in Syria, and there's a threat of like a much wider war against Iran. One should not underestimate the military strength of Israel and the United States. They can certainly do a huge amount of destruction and damage, but what they cannot do apparently is subdue any of their foes. And they can create chaos and violence and anarchy, but that is not peace. That is not a lasting settlement. But any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that really describes well what we are seeing now. We're in a period where rules don't seem to matter in terms of the use of military force. Sovereignty has gone out the window. The Israelis are attacking in all different kinds of directions, not just in Gaza, but also in Lebanon. They've taken over chunks of Syria. They struck in Iran for the first time over the last few years. They're attacking in Yemen along with the United States as well. And they've blown through every possible rule and norm that governs warfare. Over the last year and a half of genocidal violence in Gaza. This is not sustainable, and this is not going to lend to peace. And as you note, surprise, surprise, the approach of trying to kill and starve people don't seem to turn them into your friends, right? And it only seems to increase the number of enemies that you have there. And so this was obvious from the outset. And those of us who have any understanding of the region from the very early days of this knew that there was no military solution to this situation. The Israelis were, of course, enraged after October 7th. They were not interested in thinking about anything other than vengeance and destruction. But this was clear from the outset. And we're still in that place where there is no military solution. And as you note, it's the only solution that the Israelis can possibly imagine in this moment.
There's the old definition, madness is doing the same thing over and over again expecting different results, and in that sense we are in a period of madness. We have like two more minutes, and so just a very brief question and answer. I'm quite concerned about Syria, like this after the overthrow of Assad, very precarious situation there, I have to think that the continued Israeli bombing and destruction and trying to carve out its own sub-state within Syria will make that much worse. But like, what are your thoughts on this, or the vacuum that's been created there?
On the one hand, Syrians are seeing an opportunity today to build something new in a country that's long been dominated by a brutally repressive regime. And at the same time, they face a unbelievable number of challenges from outside players that all want to shape the outcomes there, including Israel, including the Russians and the Iranians, who still would like to have a hand in things, although to a lesser extent today, including the Turks. And it's a real uphill climb for Syria today. They're still dealing, of course, with American sanctions. The government is still a recognized terrorist organization as far as U.S. policy is concerned. And you're absolutely right. The Israelis would like to see nothing else than, all of the regional actors around it either embroiled in civil war or divided up into increasingly smaller states that are in conflict with each other. And so it's not a surprise that the Israelis are doing what they're doing in Syria. And it will take a lot for Syria not to descend back into major civil conflict again. But we should all hope and pray that that is not the direction that it goes in.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very sobering thought, but it's important for people to keep Syria in mind as well. So again, thank you, Yosef. This has been a very enlightening conversation.
Thanks for having me, Jeet.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.